This is a Radio Charwell original podcast.
We love science!
So sport's quite important, isn't it? Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah, we're just sitting in front of the TV all day.
No, I'm so
And also, I've done a lot of things, so I'm kind of preparing patients before surgery and taking care of them after surgery.
Wow!
I'm doing observations.
Science
to
be
concerned.
Why don't you give me a
mystery?
What do you think?
Healthcare, mental health, vaccines, and
science and beyond.
Welcome back to Science and Beyond. For this week's episode, I will, as always, split it into two parts. So, for the first part, I will talk about the winner of my competition, Discover, Create and Inspire. And then we will talk a little bit about my trip to Spain and all the history I've learned and all of the food that I ate and just a little bit into Spanish culture. So, first of all of the entries were up to a very, very high standard, and the winner is Laurie Croston. Well done, Laurie. I think that your entry was phenomenal. I really enjoyed hearing you talk about what you researched and kind of what the story's about, and reading your comic strip, which has so many colors. It was amazing. And also, thank you, Mr. Johnson, for helping me gather all of the entries. So, let's discuss the number one competition entry in more detail. So, this entry features a very vibrant comic strip, and first box definitely sets the scene with the whole of the Earth, and then we kind of further zoom in to see the astronaut and the problem that they encounter, which is a cloud of debris. And the whole storyline is just so captivating, and the descriptions are definitely top-notch, as well as Laurie's humour and the jokes mixed into it all. And I think it definitely leaps up a page on my laptop screen. It all springs to life, and there are quite a few cliffhangers, and I'm just so eager to kind of read the next part. And I think Laurie did a very good job at keeping his audience sitting at the edge of their seats. So well done, Laurie, once again. Now, let's hear Laurie describe his entry and why he finds this science topic so interesting.
Science and beyond! Radio Charwell.
So it's a comic and it's all about space, so specifically the International Space Station, which is really cool. She has 16 pressurized modules, 3 robotic arms. It has a normal crew of 4, which can dip to as low as 3 or as high as 11 when there are 2 crew from a Dragon spacecraft and 1 crew from a Soyuz. So basically, the story is these 2 astronauts and 1 cosmonaut. So the astronauts are out spacewalking. One of them's on board this robotic arm called Canadarm 2, which is really cool. It's what it sounds like. It's a robotic arm from Canada, which astronauts sometimes go spacewalking on, and the other's just sort of attached to the station. And while they're doing that, it's because the cosmonauts inside the station, and while they're doing that, they get this call from Mission Control on Earth that there's essentially a cloud of debris that's going to arrive at their location in about 2.5 hours, and it'll probably destroy the station on its first pass. Some bits might be saved. But like, well, when I say saved, I mean not destroyed, but most of it, it like lose pressure, most of the modules will be taken away, so it won't exactly fare well. So they have to like get inside from the spacewalk, they have to close the airlock, they have to repressurize it, they have to, you know, open the airlock, they have to get out of their spacesuits, get into their new spacesuits, get into their spacecraft, do all the checks, then undock. But then, like, the moment they undock, basically, they actually get hit by the debris on the station, and I'm not really sure what happens next in the story. But I just think it's, like, really interesting. So all the science that they're doing there is really cool, and all the spacecraft. So I learned a lot of what I think I needed to know beforehand from things like books, online articles, and the NASA website. But one thing that I didn't, and still have no idea how to learn, is how the hatches on the Questor interlock work. Because I guess, I mean, NASA has this whole thing about, like, it was in the whole contract when it was formed, about providing information to the public and stuff. And they do that really well on big stuff like their missions. So for instance, Webb, Hubble, Roma, and the ISS. However, small, seemingly insignificant things, like the way the hatch opens and closes, they are not so good at. So I spent literally days, including like probably close to an hour of searching on a single day in my room, just trying desperately to find some kind of video or photo or article about how the hatch is closed. Because the thing is, it has two hatches. It has this soft thermal cover to keep it at like a normal temperature, and then it has the actual thing to keep the pressure inside. And I know how the thermal one works, but I have no idea how you open and close the one that actually sort of keeps the air in. And I spent ages searching for it, but I just couldn't find it.
Well, from that, I think you can definitely tell how much hard work that Laurie has put in. And it's such a fascinating topic that he speaks about. And I decided to research a little bit more just to find out a little bit about this topic and why he likes it so much. So at the very start, Laurie mentions Canadarm2. As he says, Canadarm2 is a robotic arm that was built by the Canadian Space Agency, or the CSA. Created by both Canada and the United States, and it is permanently on board of the ISS. And it was installed in 2001. It is 70 meters long and it has 270 degrees rotation in each direction, and it's quite similar to that of a human arm. It is quite flexible, and its function is basically to assist with station maintenance, and it can even capture incoming spacecrafts. However, there is also Canadarm, which is the original one, and there is also Canadarm 3. So there's the original, and there's two, and there's three. So the first Canadarm was installed in 1981 on like a space shuttle, and now it's no longer used and it was returned to the Earth. So it wasn't permanent like Canadarm 2 is. And then Canadarm 3 is the newest edition, made solely by Canada, with a rotation of almost 360 degrees. And there are plans for it to stay permanently on the Gateway Space Station, which is basically quite similar to the ISS, but it's 1/6 of the size. And there are plans to install Canadarm3 in 2029 at the earliest, once Gateway is established in 2027. It will orbit the moon, which is called lunar orbit. And now, honestly, I'm really looking forward to kind of knowing more about how that works, and I think I'll research it further because it's a topic that I haven't really gone into much. So thank you so much, Laurie, once again for exposing me to this, because now I'm so fascinated by spacecrafts and it's great. And since you have put in so much hard work into trying to figure out how the hatch works for the Quest airlock, out of my own curiosity as well, I have decided to contact NASA to see exactly how it works. So if they reply soon, fingers crossed, I'll let you know, Laurie, how it works, okay? And in the meantime, I hope that you continue to learn more about the spacecrafts and the ISS, because it sounds like you are definitely onto something here, and it's just such a cool topic. So I wish you all the best.
Thank you.
there we go. Now, let's talk a little bit about my time in Spain. So, not too long ago, I actually went to southern Spain, to the city of Alicante. And Alicante is a beautiful city located in the province of Valencia, and it's on the coast, on the southeast. And it has a very popular landmark called the Santa Barbara Castle, but also the Explanada de España, which is a very long walkway with palm trees on the side, and it's right next to the port and the beach of Alicante. So let's dive in into two of my favorite things about my time there. So kind of the history of everything, but also the food. So the Santa Barbara Castle stands on a really big hill called Benacanto, and there's actually an image on the side of one of the mountains which resembles a face, and that explains the name, the Face of the Moor. And after 1939, the castle remained abandoned until the year 1963, and then it opened for the public, which was free of charge. But also, having walked along, there is actually an elevator that you can ride to the top with, which kind of defeats the purpose of the mountain trail, because there's different courses actually. So there's easy, there's medium, there's hard, and depending on how eager you are that day, and if it's too hot or if it's not hot at all, you can kind of decide what your challenge is for the day. And that was really, really fun, and I think the views are absolutely incredible. And I think it would be even more incredible to watch it as the sun goes down. You see the sunset, you can see the whole sea from the beach, you can see the port, you can see the whole city, and I just think it's absolutely gorgeous. And around that kind of area, there are dotted souvenir shops, and what they commonly sell are Alicante candles. So I have one with smoked vanilla and tuberose. There's coasters, there's these little garlic graters that are very authentic from the region, because I'm assuming they use quite a lot of garlic. There's fridge magnets, there's these amazing fans, and there's postcards, there's honestly a little bit of everything. But the one thing I think that I enjoyed buying the most was this really beautiful bowl, and there's painted oranges on it, and I love it, and I think it will be the perfect bowl for university. And then along the port to the kind of left side, there's this market, and you can pretty much find anything. I think there's something for everyone there. There's jewelry, there's dresses, there's notebooks, bags, bowls, handmade things, and it was just really fun having a look around and seeing what they sell. And then to the left of that, even further, is the beach of Alicante, and it's absolutely gorgeous as well, and the weather was amazing when we went there. A little bit too hot, but I think it was definitely a really fun time. And then we also went to Guadalest. So I think it was about a two-hour bus ride, and we went up these steep mountains in this bus. And honestly, I was a little bit scared because it was going back and forth, the bus. It was moving from side to side, but we got there in the end, and I think the views were amazing. It looked like a jungle. And I actually have a painting from Guadalest, because they sold very cheap ones in the souvenir shop. And on the painting, you can see that at the very bottom, there's this archway, and it's actually the entrance to one of the castles there. So as you go up, you go up kind of the side of a mountain, and you find restaurants, houses, souvenir shops. There's a church as well, and then you can climb all the way around the mountain to a church, and it's absolutely gorgeous. And we also went to a really cool waterfall, which is in another city, not too far from Guadalest, and it was really fun. However, the water there was a lot colder than the one on the beach of Alicante, so that was a bit of a shock to the system. But nevertheless, I think I had a really good time, and it was a fun experience. If you don't know, in Spain, there's something called a siesta, where during the afternoon hours, actually, most shops are closed and people rest, and I think it threw me off a little, but I think it's completely understandable given how hot it can get in these kind of areas of Spain. And then that means everyone is outside at night. So when we actually arrived, I think it was around 10 or 11 o'clock, and everyone was outside, and we were just so shocked because compared to Oxford, at Oxford, there would be no one. So I think that was definitely a big culture shock, but it was really fun because that meant that the nightlife was really good. And the people there were just so friendly, and despite our poor Spanish skills, we were able to communicate, and they really encouraged us, I think, and yeah, it was great.
Science and Beyond! Radio Kerwell!
Now, let's move on to the food. So, of course, when you think of Spain, you might think of paella and tapas. So those are the two kind of most common dishes associated with Spain. Now, I have never tried paella before, but when I went to Spain, that was my number one goal, to try something that is very authentic. And paella is one of the most authentic Valencian foods, and it is typically served from the pan. The name is actually derived from the utensil paellera, which is the flat pan that is used to serve the food in with two handles. And it's traditionally made over a wooden fire, and it's very delicious. And actually, a Spanish food historian suggests that the dish brings together two cultures, the Roman, who gave them utensils, and the Arabs, who gave them rice. And then they combined it with the seafood diet that Alicante gains from its Mediterranean coast. And voila, paella is formed. To my surprise, the original version includes tomatoes, onions, snails. And duck as well. And I actually did see that on the menu. There was a very big variety of the different types of paella that you might have. And we actually went for a mixed paella, so it had seafood, chicken, vegetables, I think there was squid, there were shrimp as well, but it was, yeah, it was very fun. Now, something that is also very popular in Spain is the Spanish beverage horchata. It is a creamy milky drink, and it's usually made without milk, but rather plant-based milk, and I find that it's really good on hot days to cool you down. And it is said that the name horchata is most derived from the word barley, which is actually hordeata, which used to be a main ingredient in horchata, but it is now the tiger nut. And when I went back to the UK, I definitely found myself craving a horchata. So I think I need to go back to Spain just to have the drink. Now, a little bit more history for you here. In the 8th century, due to Muslim rule, tiger nuts were introduced in the Iberian Peninsula. And a very similar beverage to horchata was made in the 13th century near Valencia. Now, different versions, like horchata de chufa, is the Valencian one, of course, with the tiger nuts, but there's also horchata de arroz, which is made of rice, vanilla, and cinnamon, and it's quite common in Mexico and Guatemala. But then there's also sesame horchata, which is made with soaked sesame seeds. And for example, in Puerto Rico, they pour boiling water over the sesame seeds and let them soak for around a day, 24 hours. And then they basically flavor them with sugar, vanilla, and cinnamon. And to my surprise, in the cafe that I went to, they actually put ice cream on top, which I think is definitely for the tourists, because I don't think the Spanish locals would have horchata with ice cream. Now, in the shops, I found some sweet treats, and I was very intrigued because they were completely different from the ones that you get in the UK. So, the first thing that I bought is something called polvorones, which are almond shortbreads. And polvo is the word for powder or dust, and they are actually typically coated with a thin layer of powdered sugar. They are normally produced in the Andalusia region, which is west of Valencia, and it is a type of shortbread, and mantecados is basically an umbrella term which includes provolones. but it isn't limited to just them, and it all comes down to the ingredients. However, during festive times like Christmas, polvorones are usually eaten, and much less for mantecados. And the idea of a mantecado actually came about due to a surplus of cereal and lard. And then they added flour to extend their shelf life. And then they started baking it just a little bit, the polvorones, because it has a very, very crumbly texture. And they are often added with cinnamon, lemon, or poppy seeds. And my favorite is definitely the lemon one. Estepa is the number one city in terms of mantecado production. Aside from the polvorones, I also brought something quite sweet, and you might notice that the kind of recurring theme of almonds plays a key role. So I brought something called turrón, which is a nougat confection made out of almonds, honey, sugar, egg whites, and it is very, very sweet. And there are basically two types, so it can be classified as a hard or duro. One, which is basically the Alicante variety, so I couldn't really find the soft version, and it is basically a whole block of almond in a mass of eggs, honey, and sugar, and it has to be at least 60% of the toasted almonds, and it can be difficult to break at times, and there was actually a cutting board provided with the treat. And then there's soft or blando turrón, where the almonds are reduced to a paste, so it is much easier to kind of break apart and it has a more crumbly consistency. A fun fact, the oldest existing Spanish turrón recipe is from the 16th century Manual de Mujeres, or the Women's Handbook, and it features things like cosmetics and food, so that is kind of how far the recipe dates back, so the 16th century. And it is definitely hard, but I think it's very delicious. And I think Spain is definitely one of the best kind of countries for sweet treats. And I think I really liked it. And I'm not sure if you all know, but I have been accepted to the University of Leeds to study medicine. I can't remember if I've told you all about this, and I hope I have, but I am so excited, and soon will be the time for me to go, but don't worry, I will still be releasing episodes, and I think it would be a more useful environment because I'll be surrounded by researchers, by professors, by other medical students, and I think I'll definitely be able to make even more interesting episodes with even more science. So I can't wait, and I really want to share all of the learning that I do with all of you, and I'll definitely have a couple of favorite topics, so keep your eye out for the next episode, okay? Bye, take care.
Science and Beyond.
This is a Radio Charwell original podcast.